I had an opportunity to apply for Danish citizenship after 2016. Until that point, Denmark did not have double citizenship. So I would have had to give up my American citizenship. And there was no way I was going to do that. It would be insulting to my father. He passed away in 22, and I made a resolution in 23 that I would go through all the tests and I would gain Danish citizenship. I had a lot of respect for what he did for me and for his progeny, his efterfølge, as we say in Danish, for his grandkids, who are dual citizens, Danish and American.
My name is Christian D. Bruun. I am the director of Danish Originals. Our goal is to celebrate Danish creatives who have made a significant mark in the U.S. Today, our guest is Ilya Katznielsen, a Danish-American businessman and art supporter. Welcome, Ilya.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So great to have you here. I'm speaking to you from my home here in Los Angeles. Can you tell our listeners where you are?
I'm in a sunny but very windy Copenhagen right now because it's around Easter time and typical, it's blowing very hard. Copenhagen is perfect when it's spring.
It is a beautiful place to be. In March of this year, you shared your story in front of 600 people at Copenhagen's Nørrebro Theater at a live storytelling series called The Common. Tell us a little bit about what that was. How did that come about and how did you get an invitation to that?
It was a very interesting experience. Before, I was just a storyteller to friends. Now I'm a professional because I actually got paid for being on stage, which I never expected to be a career that I would start almost at the age of 60. The idea behind this is The Moth from the United States. And interestingly, The Moth podcast was always my go-to podcast when traveling in a car with my family because there were so many really interesting and engaging stories that they told. One of the producers from The Moth, who's been living in Sweden for the last 12 years, wanted to replicate the project in Europe. So this was the first attempt. And I was invited through a friend who was also on stage. There was a cancellation and the producers asked her, "Do you know any good storytellers?" To which she responded, "Do I ever?" And that's how it started. When you are on stage, you have 12 minutes to tell a story. And I'm very grateful to the producers for guiding me, coaching me. Now I know how the TED talkers prepare for their speeches. To stand up on stage before 600 people and subsequently get a standing ovation was inspiring. But the best compliment I got was from my son, who's a ballet dancer at the Royal Theater. He came up to me and said, "Dad, now I know how you feel when you see me on stage. I'm really proud of you."
Wow. To get stamp of approval from your son, that's a big deal.
Should I tell you what the story was?
Yes, please tell me the story.
The story was quite dramatic. It dealt with my imprisonment in a German maximum security jail as a consequence of an Interpol red notice issued by the Russian state. Subsequently, Interpol ruled that the charges against me were politically motivated and instructed all member states to erase all data regarding my persona. But it took about 10 years to get there.
Wow. That's definitely a story that I want to hear more about. Maybe we should go back in time and start from the beginning. How was your journey from the Soviet Union to the U.S. and now to Denmark? How long have you been in Denmark now? 40 years?
35 years. I've had the privilege of living in this country and hopefully soon becoming a citizen.
Very good. And even though we are speaking English, I know that you're completely fluent in Danish.
Thank you. It's a compliment. I feel comfortable in Danish, though when it gets to the rather intricate conversations, I prefer English. In any case, I was born in the Soviet Union. And when I was about 7 years old, my father applied for an exit visa from the Soviet Union, which in 1974 was a very brave act. He immediately, and my mother as well, our family were branded as traitors to the motherland because why else would you want to leave the workers' paradise? The only good thing about being Jewish in the Soviet Union was there was a slight chance that you could get out. And my father took that opportunity. I later asked my dad how long he nurtured this desire for leaving the Soviet Union. And he said, "For 20 years. And I said, "So what precipitated that?" He said, when he was applying for university, they failed him on his entrance exam to the Moscow Aviation Institute. I asked him, which subject did you fail? And he said, German. I said, were you bad at German? He said, no, I was number one in my class. So what happened? They weren't letting Jews into the Moscow Aviation Institute. So instead, he applied for the Moscow Tractor Institute and got into that. In his 20-year career, he had over 40 world patents. And so when we eventually did make it to the United States, he was able to get a job as an engineer very quickly. In any case, when we applied for a visa, it was rejected. So we were called the refuseniks. Immediately after applying for an exit visa, both my parents were fired from their jobs. We were in this economic and social limbo. Economic, obvious, and social because a lot of people turned away from us, even relatives who were afraid that if they seemed too friendly with us, they would suffer the consequences. We were stateless. They took away our passports, they took away our citizenship, and made us pay for it. Very reminiscent of Nazi Germany. They take away your passport and you have to pay them for the health, education, and opportunities that they had provided you during the course of your residence in the country. 2 years later, we were granted an exit visa, and in 1976, we were able to leave the Soviet Union. We were granted asylum by the United States and came to America on December 16th, 1976, as refugees. And for many years, we celebrated that day. Actually, this year will be 50 years. We'll be celebrating 50 years of coming to America.
Incredible. How old were you and how long were you in that limbo, the stateless limbo?
I was 10 years old. It was 6 months. The transition took place in Italy. We were refugees residing in Italy while our application was being vetted.
Ah, I see. At 10 years old, so you remember this time fairly vividly, I can imagine.
I think memory functions as a point of reference. For a lot of people, if their life is very vanilla, they don't remember one event from the other. Whereas watershed moment, basically we're going to the moon. We left the Soviet Union. There was no internet. You had very little information about the outside world. My father had this dream and believed in it. And I'm very grateful to him for his vision, his perseverance, his strength of character to have gotten us out.
Where did you land and where did you live in the States when you first came?
My father, as an agricultural engineer, said, whatever you do, do not send us to New York. I'm an agricultural engineer. I can't plow Central Park. Guess where they sent us? New York City. We spent the first 3 months in America in South Bronx, which in the middle 70s was not the nicest place. We were talking about burnt out tenements, graffiti on trains. But my father, being an accomplished engineer, got a job within 3 months. And we moved to Thibodaux, Louisiana. So you can imagine my journey. Soviet Union, Italy, Rome, New York City, Thibodaux, Louisiana. If you could come up with contrasts, it would be very difficult.
Unbelievable. What was your expectations at the time when living in the Soviet Union? What was your image of what the United States was going to be like?
For many people, the word America had so much significance. We, of course, were raised on the cowboy movies. Those Hollywood movies were very popular because they were so innocuous from a political standpoint. We had this perception of the land of milk and honey, land of opportunity, something very, very special. And then, of course, you come to America and you face reality. You're coming as a refugee without any kind of resources. We were allowed to take out $300 per family that we could exchange. My father understood that he would have to hit the ground running. While we were in Italy, pretty much every day, he would spend 8 hours a day studying English. And a lot of other refugees, a very large community of people, would say to him, Leonard, relax. When you get to America, you have time to learn English. And my dad would always say, I don't have time to learn when I get there. I have to provide for my family. And that strength of character was a really fantastic example for me. When I saw the level of responsibility that he took upon himself, it wasn't just for himself. He had two kids, myself and my brother, and his mother was an invalid. He knew that he couldn't leave her alone in the Soviet Union. He took her along, of course. So the onus of responsibility on his shoulder was quite great, and he carried it with dignity and success.
Incredible. And what were the first years in the U.S. like for your family?
For me personally, it was difficult, not from the language or the cultural aspect. Anybody who studies linguistics understands that immersion of a child at that age, the acquisition of the language is quite rapid. As a 10-year-old, within 6 months, I felt very comfortable speaking English. Coming from the Soviet Union in the 70s, my problem was bullying. We left the Soviet Union because of anti-Semitism and the communist dogma. And here I was in school being called a Russian spy and a communist. It's completely opposite. I wasn't Russian. I was Jewish. I wasn't a communist. We actually were seeking the opportunities of capitalism. And that actually went on until I started wrestling in middle school. And the bullying stopped because I just started fighting back quite aggressively. That was a lot more effective than having your parents come in and having conversations. That age, basically, if you kick somebody's ass, they back off and they tell others, yeah, don't mess with him. He'll kick your ass.
And I know that to this day, you're still boxing, right?
I'm boxing. I ride my bicycle. I do Pilates. I'm almost 60 years old and I have grandkids, so I want to stay in shape for them.
That's great. How long did you stay in the U.S.?
The total in the U.S. was 15 years, from 76 to 91. After Louisiana, my father quickly got another job in the Midwest in South Bend, Indiana, and we ended up in Madison, Wisconsin, where I spent 11 of the 15 years. That is my alma mater, the University of Wisconsin-Madison. That's where I went to high school. So the most formative years of my life were spent in Madison, Wisconsin. In 1988, I won a scholarship to study at the University of Oslo. And while traveling in the Nordics, I met my wife, Vibeke. And initially, she moved to the United States. But after a couple of years in America, she told me, I really miss Denmark. And I said, I really miss Europe. So we packed up our bags and I emigrated for the second time in my life. It was a little easier because my wife is Danish. And of course, she had family here. And I had friends through my scholarship organization. But again, I was coming into a new country where I didn't speak the language, even though by that point I spoke four languages, Russian, English, Spanish, and French. But that doesn't really help you with the Danish companies. They were seeking known entities. Interestingly enough, in 91, you had the collapse of the Soviet Union. Here I was, a fluent Russian speaker who understood the culture, had been working in trade with the Soviet Union while living in the United States. And here, these Danish companies wanted to open offices in Moscow. And I would go through the interview process with some very large companies, publishing houses, consulting houses, industrial concerns for their Moscow offices. And I would go to 3-4 interviews. And in the end, I'd be one of two candidates, and they would invariably hire a Dane who didn't speak Russian, but came from CBS, Copenhagen Business School, or Copenhagen University, who spoke obviously Danish and, again, a known entity. But nothing is so bad it isn't good for something. I decided, well, if they don't want me, then I'll start my own company. And so with a Danish partner, we opened a food trading business, which was quite successful because the Soviet Union had a lot of issues with feeding its population. We were supplying food products, frozen meat, frozen fish, fruits and vegetables, beer, basically anything that you've consumed, I've sold. And that we did all through the 90s.
That must have been quite exciting times, right? The fall of the Soviet Union and the opening up of business with the West. Was that an exciting time for you? Did you feel like you were somehow reconnecting with your old country, or it was a whole new situation?
So two things here about reconnecting. As an American coming back to Russia and speaking fluent Russian, I was in my own environment. I was the cat's meow because I could understand both cultures. The Russians would trust me because I understood them. The Western suppliers would trust me because I'm Western educated, Western minded. And was very successful in building a reputation as a trustworthy business partner. That was one thing. When you talk about excitement, that's another thing. Excitement at that time was probably not the kind of excitement that you usually think about when you're thinking of business. Initially in the 90s, in exchange for our food products, we were getting non-ferrous metals that are exchanged on the London Metal Exchange. By 1993, it became extremely dangerous because it was so lucrative, people were getting killed. So at one point, I told my partner, I think we should get out of this business because it seems like every third person we know in this business has been assassinated. So that's the kind of excitement that we wanted to avoid. Also, dealing with the mob, the criminal gangs, having to deal with requests for bribes and corruption from the government authorities. So it's the kind of excitement you really don't want to have. On the other hand, the other type of excitement is opportunities. When you have a virgin greenfield market, you're the first mover advantage. If you're selling Danish Greenlandic shrimp and you're the first one on the market, you conquer the market. Or you're selling crab sticks from Korea, you're the first one on the market. Or you find pork from Brazil and you're the first one to do it, you capture a huge part of the market until the other traders pick it up. There was a lot of excitement in that respect. So excitement and opportunities, yeah.
And a little bit of danger. Can you explain what did you call it? The metals?
Oh, non-ferrous metals. So anything that's not iron, copper, zinc, aluminium, nickel, those are non-ferrous metals.
I see. So very valuable metals.
Yes. So when you have a product that is several thousand dollars per ton, and remember, this is 90s. So a nickel at $4,000 a ton, a truckload, could be worth $80,000, equivalent to about $250,000 today. That's target for hijacking. People kill for a lot less.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, and that seems to have only gotten worse too.
Funny enough, we were constantly being offered rare earth metals. And there was absolutely no market for it. Nobody wanted it. In the 90s, you didn't have as much applications for it as we have with mobile phones and the digital technology revolution over the course of the last 35 years has really advanced. But we were constantly being offered this. In the research institutes of the Soviet Union, they had stockpiles of it. They had no money, but they had these commodities. So what I was very good at is helping them trade their commodities, everything from cattle hides and pig skins, casein and citric acid, metals or any other kind of products that they had in exchange for the food. That kind of a network that I was able to develop in Europe and North America helped me help them. By the end of the 90s, I had what I call the crisis of genre. I was getting tired of the food trading business. Basically, having learned the ins and out of it, every problem already had a solution. There was nothing new. It was rather mundane. And I was in the process of getting divorced. And I needed a change. I didn't know I needed a change, but one of my best friends who was working in Russia called me and said, listen, I think there's a really great opportunity. A very large oil tanker company is looking for a commercial director, somebody to run commercially their entire fleet. To which I said, listen, I've never ran an oil tanker company. He said, what difference does it make? You've sold everything from ice cream to beer to flowers to meat. You can sell anything. Why not freight? And I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. I met with the principals of the company and they told me basically they had three criteria. Someone who speaks Russian and understands Russian culture, is Western-minded or Western-educated, and third is uncorruptible. My reputation at that point was something that was working for me, and they said that I fit all three criteria and they would love for me to join the project. The oil tanker company Volga Tanker was a behemoth from the Soviet times. It was the largest inland water tanker company in the world with over 250 vessels. And it was really run down. It was in very bad shape. We were very successful. I would say so successful that within 3 years, we were awarded by the Ministry of Transport of Russia as the best transport enterprise in the country. But with success comes unwanted attention. And hostile takeover in Russia is very different than hostile takeovers anywhere else in the world. It's at a barrel of a gun. And by 2004, we could see the writing on the wall. Putin and his kleptocrats stole Yukos oil fields. Then they stole the refineries. And it was just obvious that the next step would be the oil tankers to transport the cargo out of the country. So one day, I'm called into the office of the company president, and there with him is the head of the company security. Now, keep in mind, a company of 11,000 personnel, 250 ships, has to have security. Pretty much every large company in Russia has security. And that's intelligence, that's protection from internal threats, external threats. And the head of the security of the company was Viktor Ivanovich Stepin, former KGB lieutenant general. He sits me down and says, Ilya, you have to leave country now. I'm like, why, Viktor Ivanovich? Why do I have to leave country now? He says, we're about to be raided. And I didn't need to be told twice. 2 days later, I'm out of the country. By that time, my wife, I subsequently remarried, is 8 months pregnant. And I come home and I said, honey, we have to go back to Denmark. And she's like, oh, no, you go ahead, because I was flying every second weekend to be with my older sons. I'm giving birth in a month. I'm like, no, we have to leave. And yeah, we got a doctor's permission. And 2 days later, we were in Copenhagen.
Wow.
So what happens when you raid a company in Russia? Usually the best mechanism for the raiders, as we call them, is to saddle the company with huge tax debts. So the tax department all of a sudden comes in and says, you owe, and in this particular case, $128 million. And then you immediately issue criminal charges against the management, because even though the tax charges have not yet been proven, the criminal charges are already issued and the bank accounts are frozen and the assets are frozen. They couldn't really freeze the assets because the tankers needed to move, because the cargo had to come out of the country, because now they owned the cargo. They stole it from Yukos, but they had to get out of the country. And they couldn't arrest the bank accounts because my bank accounts I was operating were out of Denmark. So the Danish banks weren't going to freeze the bank account. And they couldn't really charge me because I'm an American citizen in Denmark. And actually, I wasn't an employee of the Russian company. I was managing a Danish company, which had a contract to run the commercial operations for the Russian company. So for the next 2 years, I kept the takeover raiders at bay. Now, can you imagine how that pissed them off? I mean, really pissed them off.
Right.
So they're used to taking over a company at a snap of a finger. And here I am resisting, protecting shareholder value, fulfilling my fiduciary responsibility. And they got so pissed, they issued criminal charges against me and put me on Interpol. I wasn't aware of this. I suspected something was wrong because every time I would fly to the United States, I would be taken in for secondary inspection. But I didn't know what it was all about. The Justice Department, the State Department, nobody in the U.S. would tell me what it was. But it was because of the Russian red notice.
What is a red notice?
So Interpol is a database for police organizations around the world. It allows any country that seeks someone's detention with the purpose of extradition to issue a red notice. And there are different kinds of notices. And I don't remember the exact color. So there's a special notice, I think it's a green one, for art objects that have been stolen. There is a special notice for missing people. So kidnapped children. There's a special notice for information about whereabouts. I know that's a blue notice. So don't arrest, but please tell us where that person is. So red notice is the detention with the purpose of extradition. In 2008, on February 29th, traveling in a car after my vacation in France with my lawyer and my business partner, we're stopped just a few kilometers from Puttgarden, which is a place where there's a ferry that goes to Denmark, to Rødby. We're stopped by a police car, and after I thought it was just a routine document check, I'm detained. I'm told, Herr Katznelson, there's a Interpol red notice on you issued by the Russians. And when I looked at it, I was like, no, this is ridiculous. Now, we knew that the Russians had tried to extradite me from Denmark previously, and it was rejected by the Danish Ministry of Justice. And my lawyer, who was in the car with me, is also a very close friend, speaks fluent German, and he told the German police, listen, this case has already been dismissed in Denmark, but they were following orders. So I'm in a holding cell in a police station in northern Germany, and all of a sudden the door opens, and three huge guys in military uniforms with short barrel machine guns, face masks, balaclavas on their heads, rush in, handcuff me, put a bag on my head, and lead me out the back. They put me in an armored car, and I can tell it's an armored car by the thunk of the door when it closes. So I'm telling them as we pull out of the parking lot, I'm nauseous. I said, I'm going to throw up all over your car, all over this bag. So they said, okay, we take the bag off, but you have to keep your head down. No. And instead, I'm looking around, and this is absurd. We're part of a 5-car convoy. There's a police car with sirens and a light flashing in the front, one in the back. And between us are 2 armored cars. There's a helicopter overhead. And they take me to a maximum security jail. Now, at the time, there was an agreement between EU and Russia that if any side wanted an extradition of a person, they would be given 40 days to provide documentation to justify that extradition.
I see.
I knew that I had no recourse. I could not defend myself. I could not present any kind of defense. I would be in jail, in a maximum security jail, until that documentation was sent, and then I could present a defense. However, if they did not present the documents, I would be released.
This is obviously very, very serious. Were you aware at the time then, even what the charges were? I'm sure you suspected what it was, but could you even find out exactly what it was?
I saw the Interpol red notice, and when I looked at it, I said, oh my God, El Chapo. Organized crime, money laundering, abuse of authority, fraud, just a shopping list.
Right, okay.
Exactly the same charges they presented in Denmark, which were repudiated and found to be without any basis or foundation. But they just regurgitated it. For the Germans, I'm just thinking of the resources that were wasted on this. In any case, the Russians waited for day 39 to present the documents. As soon as they presented it, and this was on purpose, they knew that there was no snowball's chance in hell that the Germans would believe him or that we wouldn't be able to defend against them. So finally, we were able to present a defense. And within 10 days, the German courts ruled that I should be immediately released. I should be given a laissez-passer, free passage to Germany to get home to Denmark. It was very ironic. As I'm released, I'm in the parking lot where my lawyer is waiting for me, and the prison pastor, who became a very close friend, Burkhard Baya, a brilliant man, we're still friends, visits us in Copenhagen. He said, Ilya, you're the only guest of our home here who's ever invited me to his place. He's a very kind man. He really helped me deal with this ordeal. We are in the parking lot and we're saying goodbye, and all of a sudden we're approached by 3 plainclothes, later learned federal police officers, and 2 uniformed police, and said, Herr Katznelson, would you mind coming with us? And I'm indignant. I'm like, whoa, hey, I got this laissez-passer, leave me alone. He says, no, we want to make sure that you get home safely to Denmark. I'm like, what do you mean? We want to protect you. I'm like, from whom? From the Russians, of course. I'm like, you kept me for 50 days in a maximum security jail because of a Russian Interpol red notice. And now you want to protect me from the Russians? He goes, jawohl, genau, yep. So we get in the car and they drive me to the ferry. Hans meets us there, my attorney. And so they stop everyone. And I'm with these 3 federal Bundespolizei. We come on board. They ask for the captain. Captain comes out. He says, we are federal police officers, we're armed. We're here to protect this gentleman. They had to inform the captain that there were armed people on board. And I get on board, and the first thing I do, I go to the buffet and get a Franz hot dog. because the food in jail was horrendous. I had a lot of stories about what was happening in that jail. Now I can laugh about it. For me, it is catharsis to be able to talk about it, some sort of exercising it, because at the time,
sure,
I was scared shitless.
It must have been terrifying, yeah, right.
Just the thought of being extradited to Russia, notoriously torturous prison conditions and the corrupt criminal justice system, that just was not an option. The thing is, when I was taken in that convoy, my greatest fear was that this was extraordinary rendition. I was looking around, are they taking me to the airport to put me on a plane directly to Russia? That thought, sometimes wake up in cold sweats. And this was 18 years ago, yeah.
Did anybody keep you abreast of the situation while you were in prison?
So initially, maximum security jail, I'm put in solitary confinement. They thought, like I said, El Chapo, right? But they started reading newspapers because I had been very open with my case. There were articles published about me in Denmark, in the United States. And my lawyer, Hans, I'm incredibly grateful to him. So a Danish lawyer who every week I had visitation would drive 4.5 hours to Lübeck, spend 2 hours with me, and drive 4.5 hours back. Now, you know, that's a true friend. It's not a lawyer. It is a true friend. So Hans was constantly updating me. And I had Burkhard Bayer, who visited me every day, the prison pastor, who spent at least 2 hours with me. And they took me out of solitary. By day 12, the prison director came to my cell and said, Mr. Katznelson, we know you don't belong here. There's limitation to what we can do, but we'll try to make your stay here as least uncomfortable as possible. And they did, although still in jail. But after that, my treatment was a lot more relaxed. Yeah.
I see.
Look, at the time, my greatest obstacle was boredom. In the 50 days I was there, I read 17 books. Hans was bringing me books. I saw the teaching company's DVDs of contemporary opera and a European art of the 19th century. They allowed me to keep the door of my cell open because I had claustrophobia. And so it was just to have the door open. I didn't walk out. I just keep the door open. So you have the guard walking past. And here I'm listening to a lecture on Wagner's Tristan and Isolde. And they're like, who is this guy?
Yeah.
And the thing is, on the way to the ferry, when they were escorting me out, no helicopter. Just 3-car convoy. And there wasn't an armored car. 3 federal policemen, the regular cops in front and back, like a guest of honor.
You know, I can't help but think all that you went through immigrating and moving from different countries somehow is a little bit of a reflection on the suspension of legal systems and gray areas of things being done to people today. Have you seen the Danish Oscar-winning film, Mr. Nobody Against Putin? Did you watch that film?
I did. I also had the pleasure of listening to Helle Faber's interview on Danish Originals. I was very impressed. I was impressed for a number of reasons, but I'll tell you the thing that impressed me the most. The fact that they took on this project and continued with it, knowing that at any point, if Pasha were to say, I'm out, I don't want it to be presented, I don't want it to go public, that they would stop. All the resources invested, all the money would go for naught. And they were willing to do that. And the fact, it appeared to me that they spent more effort, more energy on finding ways to protect him than on the film itself. That is incredibly honorable. Kudos to them. That's very decent. That's integrity. So, yeah.
And how does that make you feel as a Danish-American with Russian roots today?
It makes me very proud. There are many things that make me proud to live in this country, to be a contributor to Danish society, to the Danish budget, because of the things that this country does and does well, from the aid to Ukraine, to the steadfast support for democracy, for the incredible contributions to music, to art in general. I wish more countries were like Denmark, but I think the thing that makes Denmark stand out is because it is so different than the rest of the world. Yeah, as I said, grateful and proud.
Right. So you and I actually met through art.
We did.
Right. We met on the board of AFSMK, which is the American Friends of the Statens Museum for Kunst, which is the National Gallery of Denmark, an organization that helps promote Danish art and the collection of the National Gallery in the U.S. How did you find your way into the world of art?
Oh, very interesting. I think it stems from my father. He was a big book collector. Books were very valued in Russia, and art books were incredibly rare. And so when he came to the United States, he discovered there's this thing called Time Life Books. They have a library of different subjects, and you get a subscription, and every month a book is sent to you. So he discovered that there was Time Life collection of art books. And every month he would get a volume on Cézanne, a volume on Renoir, a volume on Monet, a volume on Picasso. And he would sit and diligently every evening read about a particular artist. And I think there's over 40 books in that collection. And I picked that up from him and always enjoyed learning about the artist. But then life takes its turn and I was more focused on other things. And then about 14 years ago, I'm vice president of the American Club Copenhagen. We're invited to a meeting at SMK, the National Gallery, about a project to create an organization supporting SMK's exhibitions in the United States. And I fell in love with the idea. For me, the scholarship that brought me to the Nordics had given me so many opportunities. And the idea of cultural exchange, whether education, art, music, have always been something that I supported. And here, this is an opportunity to get involved hands-on. So I immediately said, yes, I'm on board. And I became one of the founding members of the organization and joined the board and represented from the Copenhagen side. Although most of the directors and members are in the United States because it is American Friends of the National Gallery. And I felt that the mission of a cultural exchange in the United States exposes the American audience to Danish art. Yeah, it was right up my alley. So it was a real easy choice.
That's great. And it didn't just stop there. I know that you're also a founding sponsor of an initiative upstate New York at the Buffalo AKG Art Museum.
That's correct. And also along the same lines, where the director of AKG during COVID 2020 is in Copenhagen, and I'm invited by friends at a gallery to meet with him, Jannis Siren. And he starts telling me about this project where there isn't a single art institution in the United States that has a permanent Nordic contemporary art collection. And he wants to create a project that will go on for 60 years, a legacy project of bringing contemporary Nordic art to the United States in a permanent collection. And within 10 minutes of his pitch, I'm like, Jenny, I'm in. He goes, no, I have like more slides. I'm like, dude, we can do the slides, but I'm in, because it just felt so natural for my idea of cultural exchange. And this project has opened up a lot of opportunities for Nordic contemporary artists to be recognized in probably the biggest art market in the world and added considerable value to Nordic art. So very proud of that, yes.
And you're about to become a citizen?
I am. And like many others, my citizenship application has been postponed. It's been approved. But in Denmark, to become a citizen, it is through an act of parliament. And initially, it was supposed to be in October of last year. But because of the municipal elections and the Danish presidency of the EU, parliament was very busy. So they postponed it to April. And now we just had an election and there's a new parliament that's going to be in session. That has been postponed as well. So they're really making me work for it. But I think everything worth having is worth waiting for. And I can't wait to experience it. But planning big, big party, knowing that I have gone through the gauntlet, passed all the tests and have been approved, just waiting for Parliament to take their decision. Yes.
That's great. I look forward to celebrating. What is it about Danish and Nordic art that you find important to share with the world?
A couple of years back, SMK had a big exhibition called Beyond the Light at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and at the Getty in Los Angeles. And I had the opportunity of being there for the grand opening at the Getty. This was art that represented the Danish Golden Age from the middle of the 19th century. And having a lapel pin with the Danish and American flag, I had some of the guests of the Getty asking me, are you from the Danish side or American side? I said, oh, I'm from the Danish side. And they would ask me, can you explain this particular picture? What is the significance of it? And I would tell them the fact that it reflects the internalization of the national character, because the Danish Golden Age and the democracy that we have today is a consequence of very, very difficult times that Denmark experienced in the beginning of the 19th century. The loss in the Napoleonic Wars, the loss of Norway, the economic crisis of 1813, the loss of territory, a huge blow to Denmark. Danish society focused internally, focusing on intensive growth. In the age of empire, where countries were focusing on extensive growth, Denmark focused on intensive growth. The high school movement, højskolebevægelse, as we say in Danish, the focus on educating and literacy campaigns for the farmers that allowed the salon movement, where people would create gatherings where you would have philosophers and musicians and professionals and people of all walks of life come together and discuss ideas. All of these gave impetus to the revolution, the bloodless revolution, and the end of the absolute monarchy that resulted in 1849 with our first constitution. 1848 was a very tumultuous time in Europe. All these revolution, all this bloodshed, in order to get away from absolute rule of monarchy. But in Denmark, basically the bourgeoisie, the middle class, the professional class, came to Frederick VII and they said, we'd like to have a constitution. And he said, okay, no problem. And we had a constitution without a single shot being fired. And so that kind of approach and the reflection in art of this Danish internalization of its culture evolved into the country that we have today. Americans would use Denmark as an example. You have Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Well, it didn't happen overnight. There's a great Chinese proverb. When is the best time to plant a tree? 25 years ago. When's the next best time? Today. So start today with your democracy. You don't wait because, you know, it's going to take a while. Danish democracy is rooted very far back and Danish art is a reflection on it. Another artist that we represented in 2019 and 20, but was curtailed because of COVID, was L.A. Ring, a painter on the transition of the 1920th century who painted everyday people. The station master at the railroad, the postman, peasants, he was a reflection of the people. So a lot of Danish art is a reflection of the country where we live, nature, the people, and the way we view life.
And that is worth telling the world about and getting that out there as to inspire the world.
I think so.
I wanted to ask you, how did your dad feel about you moving to Denmark?
Initially, he was saddened. But I think he also saw that I had a path that I needed to create for myself, because that is what he did. I had an opportunity to apply for Danish citizenship after 2016. Until that point, Denmark did not have double citizenship. So I would have had to give up my American citizenship. And there was no way I was going to do that. It would be insulting to my father. He passed away in 22. And I made a resolution in 23 that I would go through all the tests and I would gain Danish citizenship. I had a lot of respect for what he did for me and for his progeny, his efterfølge, as we say in Danish, for his grandkids who are dual citizens, Danish and American.
I see.
I thought the question you were going to ask me is how my father felt about me going to Russia and working there.
Yes, of course. That's a follow-up question right there.
Good. Good. I anticipated that. So I called my father in 2000 after I got the offer, and he said, listen, you don't gamble with the Soviet system. I said, Dad, what are you talking about? It's not Soviet Union anymore. It's Russia. And he said, nothing ever changes in that country. And I was dismissive. I said, no, it's a totally different place. And honestly, the first 3 years from 2000 to 2003, before Putin really got his foothold, it was a land of opportunity. As I said, we were incredibly successful because I could apply Western methodology. They couldn't corrupt us, and I would get the best prices for our freight, would use the best logistical systems for our operations. But then everything turned to shit. He was prescient in his warning. He knew it was going to happen because, unfortunately, the nature of that system and that mentality does not change. I think it was very difficult for him when I was interned. He wrote to his congressman, his senator. In 2009, after my release, I gave testimony to the Joint House-Senate Helsinki Commission. It was the same session where Bill Browder talked about Sergei Magnitsky, who at that time had been jailed. He was warning about state corruption. Sergei Magnitsky ended up being murdered. Fortunately, I wasn't, but my testimony is a congressional record. I took that experience and I did something with it. I took the case together with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and an OSCE Parliamentary Assembly to reform the Interpol system. Because people who were refugees fleeing Russia would have red notices issued by Russia, and they would be detained because it was pure harassment. Any country who's a signatory to the UN Refugee Convention, and almost every country is, cannot extradite a person back to the country from which they became refugees. Article 31 of the Refugee Convention says non-refoulement. So the whole purpose of a red notice is just to harass. So after, I think, 7 years of pursuing Interpol, they changed the rules. If you have refugee status and the country from which you fled tries to issue a red notice, Interpol will ignore it. So that was an achievement, and I feel very grateful for the opportunity because I had the resources, I had the wherewithal, I had what you call a speaker platform, and had articles published in Forbes and CNN and ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, highlighted this issue using my case as an example. So I think it was an opportunity to do something with it. And I also started supporting prisoner rights organizations in Russia and very proud of the work that we did. Basically, anybody that we saved is a win.
Wow. And were you able to talk to anybody while you were in prison?
I could get a daily phone call, even though it was a maximum security jail. My wife could visit me. My lawyer had direct access with me. And I had a total of 2 visits from the U.S. Embassy, from the consular section. Once I knew what the plan was, how we're going to get me out, the stress level diminished and I could focus on the sociological experiment. I was basically a journalist implanted in a maximum security jail. I could talk to people. I kept a diary, 70 pages of notes, made for very interesting reading afterwards, of course. It took 10 years before I could read it.
Really? I'm sure it must have been traumatic.
I didn't touch it for 10 years. I didn't internalize the negative things. I saw it as, okay, what did I learn from this? What can I do to make life better for others?
Right. What are your bigger reflection on the world today and the state of the American dream, the state of the Danish dream, you can say?
I think that there are greater opportunities for upward mobility in Denmark than in the United States, unfortunately. Not unfortunate that it is Denmark, but unfortunate that the United States has really fallen behind. Access to healthcare in Denmark, access to education, is access to opportunity. This is, I think, one of the greatest achievements of Danish society. The reduced income inequality when you juxtapose to the United States, the access to the political system where decisions about legislation are not determined by the amount of money that you can contribute to political campaigns. We just had an election where the whole election cycle was 3 weeks. That's it. If you, as a candidate, wanted to garner support from potential voters, you have to meet with them. You debate. You engage. There's no television advertising. There's no billboards denouncing your opponents. There's no dirty tricks campaigns. You are presenting your views on issues. In the United States, the presidential election cycle is going to start right after the November federal elections this year, and it'll go on for 2 years. I think they estimate it'll be $4.5 billion that will be spent on the presidential election, which is utterly absurd. Money should not decide how people vote. But in the United States, that unfortunately is the case. The other thing that really concerns me is the approach of the current administration to Denmark, to Greenland. I think it is insulting to be so denigrating to your ally, so denigrating of the Danish contribution to America's war efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq. In pretty much every conflict the United States had been involved in, Denmark punched above its weight. And having had interaction with Danish veterans, it really breaks my heart to hear the President of the United States speak that way about Danish contribution. It saddens me because I know that the American servicemen and women who served shoulder to shoulder with Danes know the contributions that Danes made. And in fact, per capita, Denmark lost more servicemen in America's wars than the United States. Yeah. I hope through the educational exchanges that I support, the art exchanges, the cultural exchanges, we can bring U.S. and Denmark closer. For me, I'm a member of a number of projects and organizations whose main goal is bringing our countries together. And I hate to see the administration right now pushing us apart. It saddens me greatly. I love both countries. As I mentioned before, I came as a refugee to the United States. Regardless of the difficult time I had starting out, I ended up getting a fantastic education. My high school, Madison West, always at the forefront of National Honor Society, had phenomenal facilities and still does. The University of Wisconsin is one of the greatest public universities in the top 10 in the United States. I'm very grateful for the opportunities I had. I wish more people would be able to have those opportunities.
What did you study in university?
Oh, this is really interesting. I'm a businessman. I invest in startups, everything ranging from technology to medical devices to IT. My degrees are in history, Spanish, and international relations. I tell you, those three, they go hand in hand. History, when I visit a country, if I'm in South Korea, I know their current political situation. I can talk to them, and they often get impressed. How is it that this American living in Denmark knows about our latest presidential scandal? Spanish, pretty much everywhere around the world, I find Spanish speakers. And as soon as I see an opportunity, I just start speaking Spanish, whether it's a busboy in Los Angeles or an Argentinian bartender in Copenhagen. And it's great. I love it. I love surprising people. And international relations, it's all about anthropology, cultural exchanges. Being in sales, you have to understand people. You have to understand what they need. It's not your product that you're pushing. You're solving an issue that they have. My business education came from my experience. I tell you one thing, though, in terms of education. So I get this job as the head of all commercial operations for this huge oil tanker company. And in Russia, the season for operations starts as soon as the ice melts. And that's March through November. And then the river freezes and it's hard to skate on the ice for the tanker. And so I get hired in early November. I know very little about chartering, the law of the seas. So I get a correspondence course with the Cambridge Academy in London. I get these two huge textbooks. And I, like my father, sit down for 8 hours a day and I start studying maritime law, chartering contracts, and everything related to transport of oil. And by the time I'm ready to start selling the freight in January to prepare for the season, I feel, yeah, very comfortable. But it was my father's example of his work ethic that got me through that.
I love that. I love how he passed that on to you. And you're right, you have to be prepared and you have to put in the time. That's the road to success. Thank you, Ilya, for being part of Danish Originals, and thank you for speaking with me today. It's been a pleasure. It's been entertaining and it's been educational. And I love hearing you tell stories. And as you said, maybe that is your new career. I think that would be a good thing for the world.
Thank you, Christian. And I just want to underscore that I consider it a privilege to be on this program, a program called Danish Originals. For 35 years living in this country, I feel that I've contributed, but to be able to participate in this program is a cherry on top of the cake, to be considered a Danish original.
Thank you so much, Ilya. Thank you. For today's episode, Ilya Katznelson chose Karl Bloch's Fra et romersk osteria, or In a Roman Osteria from 1866, from the collection of the National Gallery of Denmark.
I've chosen In a Roman Osteria by Karl Bloch. Two young ladies sitting at a table with a young man are looking at the viewer and they're flirting, they're engaging, and the young man's got a knife in his belt, is incredibly stern and serious and very protective. In the background, the three people, the painter Karl Bloch, the patron Mr. Melchior, who commissioned the painting, and a third person, supposedly a friend. This painting was copied several times by the artist at the request of wealthy patrons, one of them being Alexander III of Russia, who was a very virulent anti-Semite. He had, in his version of the painting, Mr. Melchior erased, because Mr. Melchior was Jewish. I thought it was quite ironic. Another thing about Bloch, his style is incredibly realistic, and he was so popular that toward the end of the 19th century, where you had the Impressionists and other newfangled art movements, it was as an insult to say if somebody was painting realistically, oh, he's like Karl Bloch. 100 years later, Karl Bloch's paintings, again, became very, very popular. And I really like that art has waves. Artists get rediscovered this painting. It's one of my favorites, and it always brings a smile to my face.
You've been listening to Danish Originals, a podcast series that spotlights Danes who have made a significant impact in the U.S. in the areas of creativity, originality, and innovation. The series is directed by Christian D. Bruhn and hosted by Tina Yun Christensen, along with Gregers Herring, Asker Hussein, Finolf Jones, Nikolai Rotbol, and Karsten Solchuk Shack. It is produced by Teresa Lai, mastered by Sean Hedinger and Greg Williams, with original music by Joachim Swarm and executive produced by Christian D. Bruhn and Tina Yun Christensen. We invite you to subscribe to Danish Originals wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, we ask you to share it with others, give us a 5-star rating, and leave a review that will encourage others to listen. To stay in touch, you can also find us on danishoriginals.com and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Danish Originals is a fiscally sponsored project of Nordic Concepts Institute. We thank our supporters for seasons 1 to 10, who include founding sponsor American Friends of Statens Museum for Kunst, inaugural sponsor Studio Haslund, and sponsor Scan Design Foundation. We are additionally grateful to Scandinavian Airlines for featuring select episodes on their in-flight programming on long-haul flights. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next week.